"It's a lady," she said, but she wouldn't give a name. I figured that one out, and when I got to the phone at the floor desk, I found I was right. It was Ann Stanton. She had stood it as long as she could. She didn't seize me by the sleeve, for she was a few miles away in her apartment, but her voice did pretty near the same thing. I told her what I knew and answered her repetitious questions. She thanked me and apologized for bothering me. She had had to know, she said. She'd been calling at my hotel all evening, thinking I would come in. Then she'd called me at the hospital. There wasn't anybody else she could ask. When she just called the hospital and had asked for news, they'd been noncommittal.
"So you see," she said. "So you see, I had to call you."
I said I saw all right and hung up the phone and went back down the hall. In the room, nothing had changed. And nothing did change till toward 4 o'clock when the boss, who had been sunk in the chintz chair with his gaze on the artificial logs, suddenly lifted up his head, the way a drowsing dog does on the hearth to a sound you can't even hear. But the boss hadn't been drowsing. He'd been listening for that sound. One instant he held his head up intently, then swung up to his feet. "There," he exclaimed raspingly. "There." Then I heard it, for the first time, the far-off wail of the siren of the motorcycle escort. The plane had got in. In a minute a nurse came in and announced that Dr. Burnham was with Dr. Stanton. She couldn't say how long before they'd give an opinion. The boss had not sat back down after the first sound of the siren. He'd stood in the middle of the floor with his head up, hearing the siren wail and fade and wail again and die off, then waiting for the steps in the hall. He didn't sit back down now. He began to pace up and down, over to the window where he snatched back the chintz curtains to look out on the blackness of the lawn and off across the lawn, where no doubt a solitary streetlight glowed in the mist. Then back to the fireplace, where he would turn with a grinding motion that twisted the rug under his heel. His hands were clasped behind him, and his head, with the forelock down, hung forward sullenly and seemed to sway a little from side to side. I kept on looking at my picture magazines, but the solid tread, nervous and yet deliberate, stirred something back in my mind. I was irritated, as you are when the memory will not rise and be recognized. Then I knew what it was. It was the sound of a tread, back and forth, caged in a room in a country hotel beyond the jerry-built wall. That was it. He was still pacing when a hand outside was laid on the knob of the door. But at that sound, the first sound of the hand on the knob, he swung his head toward the door and froze in his tracks like a pointer. Adam walked into the room into the clutch of that gaze. The boss licked his lower lip, but he controlled the question. Adam shut the door behind him and took a few steps forward. "Dr. Burnham has examined the patient," he said, "and studied the X-ray plates. His diagnosis and my own check absolutely. You know what that is." He paused as though expecting some reply. But there was no reply, not even a sign, and the gaze on him did not relinquish its clutch. "There are two lines of action possible," he resumed. "One is conservative, the other radical. The conservative line would be to put the patient in traction, in a heavy cast, and wait for some resolution of the situation. The radical line would be to resort to surgical procedure immediately. I want to emphasize that this is a difficult decision, a very technical decision. Therefore, I want you to understand the situation as fully as possible." He paused again, but there was no sign, and the gaze did not relax. "As you know," he began again, and now his tone carried a hint of the lecture room, of academic precision. "The plate showed in lateral view a fracture and dislocation of the 5th and 6th cervical vertebrae. But the X-ray cannot show the condition of soft tissue. Therefore, we cannot know at this moment the condition of the spinal cord itself. We can learn that only by surgical action. If, upon operating, we discover that the cord is crushed, the patient will remain paralyzed for the rest of his life, for the cord has no regenerative power. But it is possible that a displaced segment of bone is merely pressing upon the cord. In that case, we can, by performing a laminectomy, relieve the pressure. We cannot predict the degree of benefit from such procedure. We might restore some, or we might restore almost all function. Of course, we should not expect too much. Some muscle groups might remain paralyzed. You understand? This time, Adam scarcely seemed to expect any response, and his pause was only momentary.
I must emphasize one consideration. This operation is very near the brain. It may be fatal, and the chances of infection are greater with the operation. Dr. Burnham and I have discussed the matter at length and are in agreement. I myself take full responsibility for advising the operation, but I want you to know that it's radical, that it is the outside chance, it is the gambler's chance.
He stopped, and in the silence, the boss's breath rasped two or three times in and out. Then he said gratingly,
"Do it."
He had taken the outside chance, the gambler's chance, but that was no surprise to me. Adam was looking inquiringly at Lucy Stark, as though he wished corroboration from her. She turned her eyes from him and looked at her husband, who had walked over to the window to look out over the black lawn. For a moment, she studied the hunched shoulders, then returned to Adam Stanton. She nodded her head slowly while her hands worked together in her lap. Then she whispered,
"Yes. Yes."
"We shall operate immediately," Adam said. "I had ordered arrangements made. It doesn't have to be done immediately, but in my judgment it's better so."
"Do it,"
the grating voice over by the window said. But the boss didn't turn around, not even when the door closed behind Adam Stanton. I went back to my picture magazines, but I turned the pages over with the greatest care, as though I couldn't afford to make a sound in the special kind of devouring stillness there was in the room. That stillness lasted a long time. While I kept on looking at the pictures of girls in bathing suits, and racehorses, and scenes of natural beauty, and long files of erect, clean-faced youths in some kind of shirt or other, lifting their arms in a salute, and detective stories acted out in six photographs with the answer on the next page. But I wasn't paying much attention to the pictures, and they were always alike anyway. Then Lucy Stark got up from her chair. She walked over to the window where the boss stood and stared out. She laid her hand on his right arm. He drew away without even looking at her. But she took him by the forearm and drew him, and after a momentary resistance, he followed her. She led him back to the big chintz-covered chair.
"Sit down, Willie," she said very quietly. "Sit down and rest."
He sank down into the chair. She turned away and went back to her own chair. He was looking at her, not at the artificial logs now. Finally, he said,
"He'll be all right."
"God grant it," she replied.
He was silent for two or three minutes, still looking at her. Then he said violently,
"He will, he's got to."
"God grant it,"
she said, and met his gaze until his eyes fell away from hers. By that time, I'd had enough of sitting there. I got up and went out and down the hall to the nurse who was on the floor desk. "Any chance of getting some sandwiches and coffee brought up here for the governor and his wife?" I asked. She said she'd get some brought up, and I told her just to have them brought to her desk, that I would take them in. Then I wandered down to the lobby again. Sadie was still there, spooking in the shadows. I told her about the operation and left her there. I hung around at the floor desk upstairs until the sandwiches arrived, then took the tray down to the waiting room. The grub and coffee, however, didn't do much to change the atmosphere there. I put a little table by Lucy with a sandwich on a plate and a cup of coffee. She thanked me and broke off a piece of the sandwich and put it to her mouth two or three times, but I could not see that she was doing it much damage. But she took some coffee. I put some food and coffee handy to the boss. He looked up out of himself and said,
"Thanks, Jack."
He didn't even make a pretense, however, of eating. He held the cup in his hand for a few minutes, but I didn't notice that he even took a sip. He just held it. I ate a sandwich and had a cup of coffee. I was pouring myself a second cup when the boss reached to set his cup down, sloshingly, on the little table beside him.
"Lucy," he said. "Lucy."
"Yes," she answered.
You know what I'm going to do?
He leaned forward, not waiting for an answer.
I'm going to name the new hospital for him. For Tom. I'm going to call it the Tom Stark Hospital and Medical Center. It'll be named for Tom.
She was slowly shaking her head, and his words stopped.
Those things don't matter, she said. Oh, Willie, don't you see? Those things don't matter.
Having somebody's name cut on a piece of stone, getting it in the paper, all those things.
Oh, Willie, he was my baby boy. He was our baby boy, and those things don't matter. They don't ever matter, don't you see?
He sank back into his chair, and the silence picked up where it had left off. The silence was still going full blast when I got back from taking the dishes and uneaten food down to the desk. It gave me an excuse for getting out. It was 6:20 when I got back. At 6 o'clock, Adam came in. He was pretty gray and stony in the face. The boss got to his feet and stood there looking at Adam, but neither he nor Lucy uttered a sound. Then Adam said,
"He will live." "Thank God,"
Lucy breathed, but the boss still stared into Adam's face. Adam stared back. Then he said,
"The cord was crushed."
I heard a gasp from Lucy and looked over to see her with her head bowed on her breast. The boss didn't show a sign for a moment. Then he lifted his hands, chest high, with the fingers spread as though to seize on something.
"No," he declared, "no."
"It was crushed," Adam said, and added, "I am sorry, Governor."
Then he left the room. The boss stared at the closed door, then slowly sank back into the chair. He kept on staring at the door, his eyes bulging and the moisture gathering in drops on his forehead. Then he jerked upright and the sound wrenched out of him. It was a formless, agonized sound, torn raw right out of the black animal depths inside of the bulk there in the chair.
"Oh," he said.
Then,
"Oh."
Lucy Stark was looking across at him. He was still staring at the door. Then the sound came again.
"Oh."
She rose from her chair and went across to him. She didn't say anything. She simply stood by his chair and laid a hand on his shoulder. The sound came again, but it was the last time. He sank back, still staring at the door, and breathed heavily. It must have been like that for 3 or 4 minutes. Then Lucy said,
"Willie?"
He looked up at her for the first time.
"Willie," she said, "it's time to go."
He stood up from the chair, and I got their coats off the couch by the wall. I helped Lucy on with hers, and then she picked up the other one and helped him. I didn't interfere. They started for the door. He had drawn himself erect now and looked straight ahead, but her hand was still on his arm, and if you had seen them, you would have got the impression that she was expertly and tactfully guiding a blind man. I opened the door for them and then went on ahead to tell Sugar Boy to get the car ready. I was there when the boss got into the car and she got in after him. That surprised me a little, but it didn't hurt my feelings if Sugar Boy drove her home. Despite the coffee, I was ready to drop. I went back inside and up to Adam's office. He was just about ready to pull out. "What's the story?" I asked.
"What I said," he said. "The cord is crushed. That means paralysis. The prognosis is that for a time the limbs will be absolutely limp. Then the muscle tone will come back. But he will never use arms or legs. The bodily functions will continue, but without control. He'll be like a baby. And the skin will be inclined to break down. He will get infections easily. The respiratory control will be impaired, too. Pneumonia will be likely. That's what usually knocks off cases like this, sooner or later."
"It sounds to me the sooner the better," I said, and thought of Lucy Stark.
"Maybe so," he said tiredly.
He was sagging now, all right. He slipped on his coat and picked up his bag. Can I drop you somewhere? He asked. Thanks, I'm in my car, I said. Then my eyes fell on the telephone on his desk. But I'll make a call if I may, I said. I'll pull the door too. All right, he said and went to the door. Good night, he added and went out. I dialed outside and got Anne's number and told her the news. She said it was horrible. She kept saying that into the telephone.
It's horrible. In a low, bemused voice, 3 or 4 times. Then she thanked me and hung up.
I left the office. I had one more errand to do. I went down to the lobby. Sadie was still there, so I told her. She said it was pretty tough. I agreed.
It'll be tough on the boss, she said.
It'll be tough as hell on Lucy, I said, for she's the one who will have to fix the baby. Don't forget that while you're giving out the free samples of sympathy. She must have been pretty tired or something, for that didn't make her mad. So I asked her if I could take her into town. She had her car, too, she said. Well, I'm going home and sleep forever, I said, and left her in the lobby. By the time I got out to my car, the sky was curdling blue with dawn. The accident occurred on Saturday afternoon. The operation was performed just before dawn on Sunday. The big payoff was on Monday. It was the Monday before Thanksgiving. That day there was a gradual piling up of events, then the rush to the conclusion, as when a great weight that has been grinding and slipping suddenly breaks the last mooring and takes the plunge. As I experienced that day, there was at first an impression of the logic of the events, caught flickeringly at moments, but as they massed to the conclusion, I was able to grasp, at the time, only the slightest hints as to the pattern that was taking shape. This lack of logic, the sense of people and events driven by impulses which I was not able to define, gave the whole occasion the sense of a dreamlike unreality. It was only after the conclusion, after everything was over, that the sense of reality returned, long after, in fact, when I had been able to gather the pieces of the puzzle up and put them together to see the pattern. This is not remarkable, for, as we know, reality is not a function of the event as event, but of the relationship of that event to past and future events. We seem here to have a paradox, that the reality of an event, which is not real in itself, arises from other events which, likewise, in themselves, are not real. But this only affirms what we must affirm, that direction is all. And only as we realize this do we live, for our own identity is dependent upon this principle. Monday morning I got to the office early. I'd slept all day Sunday, getting up only in time for a bite of dinner and then some silly movie, and being back in bed by 10:30. I came into the office with that sense you get after a lot of sleep of being spiritually pure. I went back to the boss's office. He hadn't come in. But while I was there, one of the girls came in carrying a big tray piled up with telegrams. They're all about his boy getting hurt, she said, and they keep coming in. They'll be coming in all day, I said. That would be true, all right. Every pin-feather politician, county courthouse janitor, and ambitious lickspittle in the state who hadn't seen the story in the Sunday paper would see it in this morning's paper and get off his telegram. Getting that telegram off would be like praying. You couldn't tell that praying would do any good, but it certainly never did anybody any harm. Those telegrams were part of the system, like presents for the wedding of a politician's daughter or flowers for a cop's funeral. And it was part of the system, too, for the flowers, now that we're on the subject, to come from Antonio Giusto's flower store. A girl in the flower store kept a record in a special file of all the orders that came in for a cop's funeral, and then Tony just ran through the file after the funeral and checked the names by his master list of perennially bereaved friends, and if your name was on the master list, it had sure God better be in the file for Murphy's funeral, and I don't mean any bunch of sweet peas either. Tony was a good friend of Tiny Duffy. It was Tiny Duffy who came into the office just as the girl flounced out with a cute little twitch of her skirt. He mooned in with a face full of professional sympathy and mortician's gloom, but as soon as he took in the fact that the boss was not present, he relaxed a little, showed his teeth, and said, "How's Trix?" I said Trix was okay. "You seen the boss?" he asked. I shook my head. "Gee," he said, and the sympathy and gloom appeared magically on his face. It is sure tough. It's what I always calls tragic. A kid like that, a good, clean, square-shooting kid like that, it is tragic and no mistake. You needn't practice on me, I said. It'll be tough on the boss, he said and shook his head. Just save your fire till he gets here. Where is he? I don't know. I tried to get hold of him yesterday, Tiny said, but he wasn't at the mansion. They said they didn't know where he was, but he hadn't been home. He was out the hospital a while, but I missed him there. He wasn't in a hotel either. You seem to have been thorough, I said. Yeah, Tiny said. I wanted to tell him how us boys all felt. Just then, Calvin Sperling, who was Commissioner of Agriculture, came in with a couple of other fellows. They were wearing crepe on their faces, too, till they saw the boss was not in. Then they eased off and began to snap their bubble gum. Maybe he won't be coming, Sperling suggested. He'll come, Tiny pronounced. It won't faze him. The boss is tough. A couple more of the fellows came by, and then Morrissey, who had followed Hugh Miller a long time back as Attorney General after Miller's resignation. The cigar smoke began to get thick. Once Sadie stopped at the door, laid one hand on the jamb, and surveyed the scene. Well, hi, Sadie, one of the boys said. She did not respond. She continued her survey for a moment longer, then said, Jesus Christ, and moved on. I heard the door of her own office shut. I drifted over to the window back of the boss's desk and looked out over the grounds. It had rained during the night, and now in the weak sunlight the grass and the leaves of the live oaks, even the trailing moss, had a faint sheen, and the damp concrete of the curving drives and walks gave off an almost imperceptible glimmering reflection. The whole world, the bare holes of the other trees which had lost their leaves now, the roofs of the houses, even the sky itself, had a pale, washed, relieved look, like the look on the face of a person who's been sick a long time, and now feels better and thinks maybe he's going to get well. That wasn't exactly the look on the boss's face when he came in, but it gives some idea of what that look was. He wasn't really pale, but he was paler than usual, and the flesh seemed to hang a little loose at the jawbone. There were a couple of razor nicks along the bone. Under his eyes were gray circles as though the flesh had been bruised but was just about well now. But the eyes were clear. He had come across the reception room without making any noise on the thick carpet, and for an instant he stood in the doorway of the office before anybody noticed his arrival. The chatter didn't die, it was frozen in mid-syllable. Then there was a kind of noiseless scurry and fumble to adjust the funeral faces that had been laid aside. Then, with the faces in place and only a little askew, they crowded around the boss and shook his hand. They told him they wanted to tell him how they felt. You know how us boys all feel, boss, they said. He said yes, he knew, very quietly. He said yes, yes, and thank you. Then he moved toward the desk, the boys falling away from him like water from the prow of a ship when it's first warped out from the pier and the screw makes the first revolutions. He stood before the desk, handling the telegrams, looking at them, letting them drop. Boss, somebody said. Boss, those telegrams, that shows you now. That shows you how folks feel about you. He said nothing. Just then the girl came in with another batch of telegrams. She set the tray on the desk in front of him. He fixed her with his glance. Then he laid his hand on the pile of yellow paper and gave it a slight shove and said in a quiet, matter-of-fact voice, Get this muck out of here. The girl got the muck out of there. The bloom had gone from the occasion. The boys began to drift out of the office and off to the swivel chairs which had not been warmed that morning. As Tiny was leaving, the boss said, Tiny, wait a minute. I want to talk to you. Tiny came back. I was heading out, too, but the boss called me. I want you to be in on this, he said. So I sank into one of the chairs over by the wall. Tiny disposed himself in a big green leather chair to one side of the desk, crossed his knees to the great strain of his hams and of the fabric which covered them, inserted a cigarette in his long holder, lighted it, and waited. The boss was in no hurry. He brooded a full minute before he lifted his eyes to Tiny Duffy. But then he came in fast. "There won't be any contract with Larson," he said. When breath came back, Tiny managed,
"Boss, boss, you can't, boss."
"Yes, I can," the boss said without raising his voice.
"You can't, boss. It's all fixed up, boss."
"It isn't too late to unfix it," the boss said. "It isn't too late."
"Boss, boss."
The word was almost a wail, and the cigarette ash was falling down the starched white front of Duffy's shirt.
"You can't break your word to old Larson. He's a good guy, and you can't. You're a square shooter, boss."
"I can break my word to Larson," the boss said.
"You can't. You can't change your mind, boss. Not now. You can't change it now."
The boss rose very abruptly from his chair at the desk. He fixed his eyes on Tiny and said, "I can change a hell of a lot of things." In the ensuing silence, the boss came around the desk. "That's all," he said in a voice not much more than a husky whisper. "And you can tell Larson to do his damnedest." Tiny got to his feet. He opened his mouth several times, wet his lips, and seemed about to speak, but each time the now gray face closed back up over the expensive bridge work. The boss went up to him.
"You tell Larson," he said. "Larson is your pal, and you tell him."
He punched Tiny's front with a stiff forefinger.
"Yeah," he said. "He's your pal, and when you tell him, you can put your hand on his shoulder."
Then the boss grinned. I hadn't expected a grin, but it was a wintry and uncomforting grin. It put the seal on everything that had been said. Tiny made the door and was gone. He didn't bother to close it, but kept on going through without a pause, dwindling away over the long green carpet. Then he had disappeared. But the boss was not watching his departure. He was staring moodily down at the bare top of his desk. After a moment, he said, "Shut the door." I got up and shut it. I didn't sit back down, but stood in the open space between the desk and the door, waiting for him to say whatever it was he was going to say. Whatever it was, he didn't say it. He merely looked up at me with a look that was innocent and questioning and asked, "Well?" I don't know what it was he wanted me to say or what he expected me to say. Since that time, I've thought a good deal about that. That was the time for me to say whatever it was I was ever going to have to say to Willie Stark, who had been Cousin Willie from the country and who was now the boss. But I didn't say it. I shrugged my shoulders and said, "Well, it doesn't matter if you kick Tiny around some more. He's built for it. But Larson is a different kind of cookie." He continued to look at me and seemed about to say something, but the question faded off his face. Then he said, "You gotta start somewhere." "Start what?" He studied me a moment before he said,
"Skip it."
I went on back to my own office. That was how that day started. I got to work on a last review of the subsidiary figures for the tax bill. Swinton, who was handling the thing through the Senate, had wanted them Saturday, but I'd been running behind on my homework. I had had that date to meet Swinton and the boss Saturday evening, but things had not fallen out that way. Later in the morning, I ran into a kink. I went out into the big room and started for the boss's door. The girl out there said he'd gone across to Sadie Burke's office. The door there was closed. I hung around a few minutes in the big room, waiting for the boss to come out, but the door stayed closed. Once I could hear a voice raised beyond the door, but then it dropped. The ringing of my own telephone bell took me back into my office. It was Swinton saying, "What the hell? Why didn't I get the figures down to him?" So I got my papers together and went down to see Swinton and give him the stuff. I was with him about 40 minutes. When I came back up to the office, the boss was gone. "He's gone to the hospital," the girl said. "He'll be back this afternoon." I looked over toward Sadie's door, thinking maybe she could help me and Swinton. The girl caught my glance. "Miss Burke," she said, "she's gone too."
"Where'd she go?"
"I don't know," the girl replied. "But I can tell you this, Mr. Burden. Wherever it is, she sure must already be there, the way she tore out of here." Then she smiled with that knowing, snotty little secret way the hired help always uses, to make you think they know more than they're telling, and reached up a nice, rounded, little red-nailed white hand to tuck in a stray back lock of really beautiful corn-colored hair. Having tucked in the lock, with a motion which raised her breast for Mr. Burden's inspection, she added, "And wherever it is she's gone, they probably won't like her getting there, to judge from the look on her face when she left." Then she smiled sweetly to show how happy any place would be to have her arrive there. I went back into my office and gave some letters until lunch. I had a sandwich down in the basement cafeteria of the Capitol, where eating was like eating in a jolly, sanitary, well-run, marble-glistening morgue. I ran into Swinton, jawed some with him, and went, at his suggestion, up to the Senate when it reconvened after lunch. About 4 o'clock, a page came up to me and handed me a slip of paper. It was a message from upstairs. It read, "Miss Stanton telephoned to ask you to come right away to her apartment. It is urgent." I crumpled up the slip, threw it down, and headed up to my office for my coat and hat. I told them in the office to notify Miss Stanton I was on my way. When I got outdoors, I discovered that it had begun to rain. The clean, pale sunlight of the morning was gone now. Anne answered my knock so quickly that I figured she must have been standing by the door. But when the door flung open, I might not have recognized, at the first glance, the face I saw there, unless I had known it to be Anne Stanton's. It was white and desperate and ravaged, and past the tears which you could know had been shed, and somehow you could know what kind of tears they had been, tardy, sparse, and painful, quickly suppressed. She clutched my arm with both hands as though to support herself.
"Jack," she exclaimed, "Jack."
"What the hell?" I asked, and shoved the door shut behind me.
"You've got to find him. You've got to find him. Find him and tell him."
She was shaking as if with a chill. "Find who?"
"Tell him how it was. Oh, it wasn't that way. Not what they said."
"For Christ's sake, what who said?"
"They said it was because of me. Because of what I did. Because..."
"Who said?"
"Oh, you've got to find him, Jack. You've got to find him and tell him and bring him to me." And
I grabbed her hard with a hand on each shoulder and shook her. "Look here," I said. "You come out of this. Just stop jabbering a minute and come out of this." She stopped talking and stood between my hands in my clutch and looked up at me with her white face and shivered. Her breathing was shallow, quick, and dry. After a minute, I said, "Now tell me who you want me to find."
"Adam," she said, "it's Adam."
"Now why do I find him? What's happened?"
"He came here and said it was all because of me, of what I had done."
"What was because of what you had done?"
"He was made director because of me, that's what he said. Because of what I had done, that's what he said, and he said..." "Oh, Jack, he said it."
"Said what?"
"He said he wouldn't be paid pimp to his sister's whore." "He said that. He said that, Jack, to me, Jack. And I tried to tell him how it was, and he pushed me, and I fell down on the floor, and he ran out. He ran out, and you've got to find him, Jack, you've got to, and..."
And she was off again on the jabber. I gave her a good shaking. "Stop it," I commanded. "Stop it or I'll shake your teeth out." When she had quieted down again and was hanging there between my hands, I said, "Now start slowly from the start and tell me what happened." I led her over to a chair and pushed her down into it. "Now tell me," I said, "but take it easy." She looked up at me for a moment as though she were afraid to begin. "Tell me," I said.
"He came up here," she began. "It was about 3 o'clock. As soon as he came in the door, I knew something terrible had happened. Something terrible had already happened to me today, but I knew this was another terrible thing. And he grabbed me by the arm and stared in my face and didn't say a word. I guess I kept asking him what was the matter, and he held my arm tighter and tighter."
She pushed the sleeve up and showed the bruise marks halfway down the left forearm.
"I kept asking him what was the matter, and all at once he said, 'Matter, matter, you know what's the matter.' Then he said how there had been a telephone call to him, how somebody, a man, that was all he said, had called and told him about me, and..."
She didn't seem to be able to go on. "About you and Governor Stark," I completed it for her. She nodded.
"It was awful,"
she whispered, not at me, but raptly to herself, and repeated,
"It was awful."
"Stop that and go ahead," I ordered, and shook her. She came up out of it, looked at me, and said,
"He told him about me and then how that was the only reason he was ever made director, and how now the governor was going to dismiss him as director because he had paralyzed his son with a bad operation, and how he was going to get rid of me, throw me out. That was what that man said on the telephone, throw me out, because of what Adam did to his son, and Adam heard him and ran right over here because he believed it. He believed it about me."
"Well," I demanded savagely, "the part about you's true, isn't it?"
"He ought to have asked me," she said, and made a distracted motion with her hands. "He ought to have asked me before he believed it."
"He's not a half-wit," I said, "and it was there, ready to be believed. You're damned lucky he didn't guess something long back, for if—" She seized me by the arm, and her fingers dug in.
"Hush, hush," she said. "You mustn't say it. For nothing was that way, and not the way Adam said. Oh, he said terrible things. Oh, he called me terrible things. He said if everything else was filthy, a man didn't have to be—" "Oh, I tried to tell him how things were, how they weren't like," he said, "but he pushed me so hard I fell down. And he said how he wouldn't pimp to his sister's whore, and nobody would ever say that about him. And then he ran out the door, and you've got to find him and tell him, Jack, tell him, Jack."
"Tell him what?"
"Tell him it wasn't like he said. You've got to tell him that. You know why I did everything I did. You know what happened. Oh, Jack."
And she grabbed my sleeve and hung on.
"It wasn't like that. It wasn't horrible like that. I tried not to be horrible. Was I, Jack? Was I? Tell me, Jack."
I looked down at her. "No," I said, "you weren't horrible.
But it has happened to me. It has all happened to me, and he's gone."
"I'll find him," I said, and detached myself from her, ready to go.
"It won't do any good."
"He'll listen to sense," I said.
"Oh, I don't mean Adam. I mean—"
"Stark?"
She nodded, then said, "Yes, I went to the place out of town we used to meet in. He called me early this afternoon. I went there and he told me he's going back to his wife."
"Well, I'll be damned," I said. Then I pulled myself together and headed for the door. "I'll get Adam," I said.
"Get him," she said, "get him, for he's all I've got now."
As I stepped out the door of the apartment house into the rain, I reflected that she had Jackie Burden, too, at least as an errand boy. But I made the reflection without bitterness and quite impersonally. Finding somebody in a city if you can't call in the cops is quite an undertaking. I'd tried it often enough back when I was a reporter, and it takes luck and time. But one rule is always to try the obvious first, so I went to Adam's apartment. When I saw his car sitting out front, I figured I'd played into the blue ones. I parked my own car, noticed that the driver's door of his car was open and might get swiped off by a passing truck, and was certainly letting the seat get wet, slammed it shut as I passed, and went on into the apartment house. I knocked vigorously on the door. There was no answer. But that didn't mean anything. Even if Adam was there, he might not be willing, under the circumstances, to answer his door. So I tried the knob. The door was locked. I went down to the basement and dug out the Negro janitor and told him some cock-and-bull story about having left some stuff up there in Adam's place. He'd seen me around with Adam a lot, and so he let me in. I prowled through the place, but no Adam. Then I spied his telephone. I called his office, then the hospital, then the medical school office, then the exchange where the doctors left numbers when they weren't at their usual haunts. It was no go. Nobody knew anything about Adam. Or rather, each one had a pretty good idea where he was, but the idea was never any good. That left all the town wide open.
This ends Disc 16. All the King's Men, Disc 17.
I went back down into the street. The fact that the car was there was funny. He had abandoned it. Where in the hell did a man go off in the rain, on foot, this time of day, or night, rather, for it was dusk now? I thought of the bars. For it's a tradition that a man, when he's received a great shock, heads for a bar, puts his foot on the rail, orders 5 straight whiskies in a row, downs them one after another while he stares with uncomprehending eyes at the white, tortured face in the mirror opposite him, and then engages the bartender in a sardonic conversation about life. but I couldn't see Adam Stanton playing that game. But I went to the bars anyway. That is, I went to a lot of them. A lifetime isn't long enough to go to all the bars in our city. I began with Slade's place, had no luck, asked Slade to try to hang on to Dr. Stanton if he came in, and then moved through the other establishments of chromium, glass bricks, Moros, colored lights, comfy old English worm-eaten oak, sporting prints, comic frescoes, or three-piece orchestras. Around 7:30, I called up Adam's office and then the hospital again. He wasn't at either place. When they told me that at the hospital, I said I was calling for Governor Stark, whose son was there as a patient of Dr. Stanton, and could they please try to dig up something. They came back with the report that Dr. Stanton had been expected well before 7, that he had had an appointment with another doctor to examine some plates, but that he had not come. They'd been unable to locate him at his office or at his home. Would I like to leave a message for Dr. Stanton when he came in? I said yes, to have him get in touch with me at the earliest possible moment. It was important. I would leave word at my own hotel as to my whereabouts. I went back to my hotel and had a meal in the coffee shop, having left word at the desk to page me if a call came. But none came. So I dawdled in the lobby with the evening papers. The Chronicle had a long editorial lauding the courage and sound sense of the handful of men in the Senate who were making a fight against the administration's tax bill, which would throttle business and enterprise in the state. There was a cartoon opposite the editorial. It showed the boss, or rather a figure with the boss's head but a great swollen belly, dressed in a Buster Brown suit with the little pants tight above great hairy thighs. On one knee the monster balanced a big pudding, and from the gaping hole in the top had just plucked a squirming little creature. The pudding bore the label The State, and the squirming little creature the label Hard-Working Citizen. From the mouth of the boss's head came one of those balloons of words the comic strip artists use to indicate the speech of their characters. It said, "Oh, what a good boy am I." Under the cartoon was the caption, "Little Jack Horner." I read on down through the editorial. It said that our state was a poor state and could not bear the burden thus tyrannically imposed upon it. That was an old one. Every time the boss had cracked down. Income tax, mineral extraction tax, liquor tax, every time it had been the same thing. The pocketbook is where it hurts. A man may forget the death of the father, but never the loss of the patrimony. The cold-faced Florentine, who is the founding father of our modern world, said, and he said a mouthful. "This is a poor state," the opposition always screamed. But the boss said, "There is a passel of poor folks living in it, and no mistake, but the state isn't poor. It's just a question of who's got his front feet in the trough when slopping time comes. And I aim to do me some shoving and thump me some snouts." And he had leaned forward to the crowd with the shagged down forelock and the bulging eyes, and had lifted his right arm to demand of them and of the hot sky, "Are you with me? Are you with me?" And the roar had come. "More money for graft," the opposition always screamed. "Sure," the boss had said, lounging easy. "Sure, there's some graft, but there's just enough to make the wheels turn without squeaking. And remember this, there never was a machine rigged up by man didn't represent some loss of energy. How much energy do you get out of a lump of coal when you run a steam dynamo or a locomotive compared to what there actually is in that lump of coal? Damned little. Well, we do a hell of a lot better than the best dynamo or locomotive ever invented. Sure, I got a bunch of crooks around here, but they're too lily-livered to get very crooked. I got my eye on them. And do I deliver the state something? I damned well do." The theory of historical costs, you might put it. All change costs something. You have to write off the costs against the gain. Maybe in our state change could only come in the terms in which it was taking place, and it was sure due for some change. The theory of the moral neutrality of history, you might call it. Process as process is neither morally good nor morally bad. We may judge results, but not process. The morally bad agent may perform the deed which is good. The morally good agent may perform the deed which is bad. Maybe a man has to sell his soul to get the power to do good. The theory of historical costs. The theory of the moral neutrality of history. All that was a high historical view from a chilly pinnacle. Maybe it took a genius to see it, to really see it. Maybe you had to get chained to the high pinnacle with the buzzards pecking at your liver and lights before you could see it. Maybe it took a genius to see it. Maybe it took a hero to act on it. But sitting there in the lobby, waiting for the call which did not come, I was willing to let those speculations rest. I went back to the editorial. That editorial was shadowboxing, all right. It was shadowboxing, for at the very minute, it was just as likely true as not that the vote was being called up in the Capitol, and it would take the winged hosts to make the vote different from what it was going to be after the McMurphy boys had talked themselves out and the count was called. It was around 9 o'clock when I was paged, but it wasn't Adam. It was a message from the Capitol saying the boss was there and wanted me to come up. I left word at the desk that if Dr. Stanton should call me, he was to be asked to call the Capitol. I would leave instructions with the operator on the switchboard there. Then I rang up Anne to give her the news, or rather the no news, about my efforts to date. She sounded calm and tired. I went out to my car. It had been raining again, for the gutter by the curb was running with a black stream which gleamed like oil in the lights of the street. But it had let up now. When I pulled into the Capitol grounds, I saw that the place was pretty well lit up. But that wasn't surprising, even at that hour when the legislature was in session. And when I got inside, the place was certainly not uninhabited. The salons had broken up shop for the evening and were milling about in the corridors, especially at those strategic points where the big brass spittoons stood. And there were plenty of other people around, too. There were a lot of reporters and herds of bystanders, those people who love to have the feeling that they're around when something big is happening. I worked through the place and up to the boss's office. They told me there that he'd gone down with somebody to the Senate. "There wasn't any hitch about the tax bill passing, was there?" I asked the girl. "Don't be silly," the girl said. I started to tell her that I'd been around there back when she was lying in the crib sucking her thumb, but didn't do it. Instead, I asked her to take care of the business of Adam's call for me and went down to the Senate. At first I didn't spot the boss. Then I saw him off to one side with a couple of the senators and Calvin Sperling, and discreetly in the background several other men, just hangers-on, who were warming their hands at the blaze of greatness. Over to one side of the boss I saw Sugar Boy lounging against the marble wall, with his cheeks drawn in to suck the sugar cube, which at that moment, no doubt, was dissolving its bliss down his gullet. The boss stood with his hands clasped behind him and his head hanging a little forward. He was listening to something one of the senators was telling him. I approached the group and stood back from it, waiting. In a minute I caught the boss's eye and knew that he had seen me, so I went over to Sugar Boy and said, "Hello." He managed to get the word out after several efforts. Then he resumed work on the sugar. I leaned against the wall beside him and waited. 4 or 5 minutes passed, and the boss still stood there with his head hanging forward, listening. He could listen a long time and not say a word, just let the fellow pour it out. The stuff would pour out, and the boss would just be waiting to see what was in the bottom of the bucket. Finally, I knew that he had had enough. He knew what was in the bottom of the fellow's bucket, or that there wasn't anything there, after all. I knew that he had had enough, for I saw him suddenly lift his head up sharp and look straight at the man. That was the sign. I stopped leaning against the wall. I knew the boss was ready to go. He looked at the man and shook his head. "It won't wash," he said in a perfectly amiable fashion. It was loud enough for me to hear. The other fellow had been talking low and fast. Then the boss looked over at me and called, "Jack?" I went to him. "Let's get upstairs," he said to me. "I want to tell you something." "Okay," I said, and started toward the door. He left the men and followed me, catching up with me at the door. Sugar Boy fell in just on his other side and a little back. I started to ask the boss how the boy was, but thought better of it. It was just a question of the kind of badness, and there wasn't any use asking about that. So we moved on through the corridor to the big lobby, where we would take an elevator up to his office. Some of the men lounging along the corridor stepped back a little and said, "How did you, Governor?" or "Hi, boss?" But the boss only bowed his response to the greetings. The other men, those who said nothing, turned their heads to watch the boss as he passed. There wasn't anything out of the ordinary about all that. He must have passed down that corridor 1,000 times, or near that many, with men calling out to him or saying nothing and following with their eyes his progress over the glittering marble. We came out into the great lobby, under the dome, where there was a blaze of light over the statues which stood with statesmanlike dignity on pedestals to mark the quarters of the place, and over the people who moved about in the area. We walked along the east wall, toward the inset where the elevators were. Just as we approached the statue of General Moffat, a great Indian fighter, a successful land speculator, the first governor of the state, I noticed a figure leaning against the pedestal. It was Adam Stanton. I saw that his clothes were soaked and that mud and filth were slopped up his trousers half to the knees. I understood the abandoned car. He'd walked away from it in the rain. Just as I saw him, he looked in our direction, but his eyes were on the boss, not on me. "Adam," I said, "Adam." He took a step toward us, but still didn't look at me. Then the boss veered toward Adam and thrust out his hand in preparation for a handshake. "How do you do, doctor?" he began, holding out his hand. For an instant, Adam stood there immobile, as though about to refuse to shake the hand of the man approaching him. Then he put out his hand, and as he did so, I felt a surge of relief and thought, "He's shaking hands with him. He's all right now. He's all right." Then I saw what was in his hand, and even as I recognized the object, but before the significance of the recognition had time to form itself in my mind and nerves, I saw the two little spurts of pale orange flame from the muzzle of the weapon. I didn't hear the report, for it was lost and merged with the other more positive staccato series of reports on my left. With his right arm still extended, Adam reeled back a step, swung his reproachful and haggard gaze upon me, and fixed it, even as a second burst of firing came and he spun to the floor. In the astonishing silence, I rushed toward Adam as he fell. Then I heard, somewhere in the lobby, a woman begin screaming, then a great rush of feet and babble of voices. Adam was bleeding heavily. He was stitched across the chest. The chest was all knocked in. He was already dead. I looked up to see Sugar Boy standing there with the smoking automatic in his hand, and off to the right, near the elevator, a highway patrolman with a pistol in his hand. I didn't see the boss, and thought, he didn't hit him. But I was wrong. Even as I thought that and looked around, Sugar Boy dropped his automatic, clattering to the marble, and uttering some strangled, animal-like sound, rushed back beyond the statue of Governor Moffat. I laid Adam's head back on the marble and went beyond the statue. I had to shove the people back now they were crowding so. Somebody was yelling, "Stand back, stand back, give him air." But they kept crowding up, running to the spot from all over the lobby and from the corridors. When I broke through, I saw the boss sitting on the floor, breathing heavily, staring straight ahead. He had both hands pressed to his body, low on the chest and toward the center. I could see no sign that he was hit. Then I saw a very little ooze of blood between two of the fingers, just a little. Sugar Boy was leaning above him, weeping and sputtering, trying to speak. He finally managed to get out the words,
"Does it hurt much, boss? Does it hurt?"
The boss didn't die there in the lobby under the dome. In fact, he lived quite a while and died on a clean, white, antiseptic bed with all the benefits of science. For a couple of days it was given out that he would not die at all. He was seriously wounded. There were two little 25-caliber slugs in his body, slugs from a little toy target pistol Adam had had since he was a kid. But an operation was possible, and he was a very strong man. So there was, all over again, the business of the waiting room, with the potted plants and watercolors and artificial logs on the cozy hearth. A sister of Lucy Stark came with Lucy the morning of the operation. Old Man Stark, the boss's father, was too feeble to leave Mason City. You could see that Lucy's sister, a woman a good deal older than Lucy, dressed in country black with high-laced black kid shoes, was a strong-minded, sensible woman who had been through a lot and knew how to help somebody else through. You could look at her squarish, slightly reddened, coarse-skinned hands with their square-cut nails and know that she knew how to take hold. When she entered the waiting room there at the hospital and cast a practiced and critical, not quite scornful glance over the potted plants and the artificial logs, it was like a pilot mounting to the pilot house and taking over. She sat very stiff and severe in a chair, not one of the chintz-covered soft ones. She was going to permit no spilling over of emotion, not in a strange room and at that time of day, the time of day when every day there was breakfast to get and the children to fix and the men to clear out of the house. There would be a proper place and time. After it was over, after she got Lucy home, she would put her to bed in a room with the curtains drawn and would put a cloth dabbled with vinegar on her forehead and would sit by the bed and hold her hand and would say, "Now just you cry if you want to, baby. Then you'll feel better. Then you lie still and I'll sit here. I won't leave you, baby." But that would come later. Meanwhile, Lucy now and then stole a look across at her sister's hewn and eroded face. It wasn't exactly a sympathetic face, but it seemed to have what Lucy was looking for. I sat over on the couch and looked at the same old picture magazines. I felt definitely that I was out of place. But Lucy had asked me to come.
"He would want you to be there," she had said.
"I'll wait down in the lobby," I said. She shook her head.
"Come upstairs," she said.
"I don't want to be underfoot. Your sister will be there," you said.
"I want you to," she had said, and so there I was.
And it was better, I decided, even if I was out of place, than being down in the lobby with all the news hawks and politicos and curiosity seekers. It didn't take them awfully long. They said the operation was a success. When the nurse who had brought the news said that, Lucy slumped in her chair and uttered a dry, gasping sob. The sister, who herself had seemed to relax a little at the words, looked sharply at Lucy. "Lucy," she said, not loud, but with some severity. "Lucy?" Lucy raised her head, met the sister's reproving gaze, murmured humbly,
"I'm sorry, Ellie, I'm sorry. It's just that I've...
"We must thank God," Ellie announced. Then she rose briskly as though she were about to step right out and do that before it slipped her mind. But she turned to the nurse. "When can she see her husband?" she asked.
"It'll be some time," the nurse said. "I can't tell you exactly, but it'll be some time. If you wait here, I can let you know."
She moved to the door. There she turned and asked,
"Can I get anything for you? Some lemonade, some coffee?"
"That's right kind and considerate," the sister said, "but we'll just say no thanks this time of morning." The nurse went out, and I excused myself and followed. I went down to the office of Dr. Simmons, who had performed the operation. I'd known him around the place. He was a sort of friend of Adam, about as good a one as Adam had, for he never had chummed up with anybody, that is, anybody except me, and I didn't count, for I was the friend of his youth. I had known Dr. Simmons around the place. Adam had introduced us. Dr. Simmons, a dry, thin, grayish man, was at his desk writing something on a big card. I told him to finish what he was doing. He said he was about through. The secretary picked up the card and put it into a filing cabinet, and he turned to me. I asked him how the governor was doing. "The operation had been a success," he said. "You mean you got the bullets out?" I asked. He smiled in a sort of chilly way and said he meant a little more than that. "He's got a chance," he said. "He's a strong man." "He's that," I agreed. Dr. Simmons picked up a little envelope from his desk and emptied the contents into his hand. "No matter how strong they are, they can't take much of this diet," he said, and held out his hand, open, to show me the two little pellets resting there. A 25-caliber slug is small, all right, but these looked even smaller and more trivial than I had remembered. I picked one of them out of his hand and examined it. It was a little misshapen slug of lead. Fingering it, I thought of how a long time back, when we were kids at the landing, Adam and I used to shoot at a pine board, and how sometimes we had dug the slugs out of the soft wood with a pocket knife.